Let's take a moment of silence to enter into meditation. You can take a deep breath or two if you like. Let us take a moment to connect with the best within us. May we have the courage to believe in our own inherent goodness and the inherent goodness of others. May we have the courage to believe that our world can reach its potential with our help. Though someone may laugh at our naivety or cry because we did not succeed the first time. May we have the wisdom to love and be loved, even in those impossible times, and to laugh often, holding fast to what we believe. The reading this morning comes from a collection of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's writings, Letters and Papers from Prison. I'm going to use gender-inclusive language for this reading, but not in the sermon, unfortunately, because it got too clunky. So, in 1943, Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote the following: "It is wiser to be pessimistic. It is a way of avoiding disappointment and ridicule. And so wise people condemn optimism. The essence of optimism is not its view of the present, but the fact that it is the inspiration of life and hope when others give in. It enables a man or a woman to hold their head high when everything seems to be going wrong. It gives them strength to sustain reverses and yet to claim the future for themselves instead of abandoning it to their opponent. It is true that there is a silly, cowardly kind of optimism, which we must condemn. But the optimism that is will for the future should never be despised, even if it is proved wrong 100 times. It is health and vitality, and the sick man or woman has no business to impugn it. There are people who regard it as frivolous, and some Christians think it impious for anyone to hope and prepare for a better earthly future. They think that the meaning of present events is chaos, disorder, and catastrophe. And in resignation or pious escapism, they surrender all responsibility for reconstruction and for future generations. It may be that the day of judgment will dawn tomorrow. In that case, we shall gladly stop working for a better future, but not before." I read the work of Dietrich Bonhoeffer for the first time this fall. Before then, I had no idea who Bonhoeffer was. At my seminary, there is a room dedicated to Bonhoeffer that chronicles his life in Europe and New York through a series of black and white photographs. Now that I know more about what he did for this world spiritually and politically, I like to spend time studying those pictures in awe, wondering where I might find the same integrity and devotion he demonstrated throughout his life. For those of you who don't know Bonhoeffer yet, let me introduce you. Bonhoeffer was born in Germany in 1906 to a doctor and a teacher. After being educated and finding his calling as a theologian in Germany, Bonhoeffer was forced to move to America to teach as Hitler's dominance spread. For a short time, he took up residence at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. But in 1939, the weight on his conscience was too great. Bonhoeffer listened to the news of growing horrors at home while observing how he and his colleagues continued to do theology, theorizing about human nature and the presence of God, while overseas those being tortured and murdered for what they believed were crying out. Bonhoeffer left the safety of his American life as a theological professor in a comfortable apartment to return to Hitler's Germany and act on the principles of faith he taught every day. He enjoyed a few years of uneasy freedom, involving himself in various missions to help Jews escape German territory. Bonhoeffer wrote openly against Hitler and about the Christian duty to protect Jews and uphold their sacred humanity. As a result, he was imprisoned in a concentration camp. After smuggling his written thoughts out into the world for 2 years, he was executed in 1945, just before the end of the war. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a man of faith, bold enough to die for his principles. Comforted only by his deep-set optimism in human potential, as we heard in the opening reading. Bonhoeffer is an exemplary figure for any person of faith or otherwise, but I find much of Bonhoeffer's theology and life's work to be in specific alignment with Unitarian Universalist ideals. As a UU myself, I feel deeply inspired by Bonhoeffer's work and the implications it carries for UU theology and social action. I will begin by talking about what Bonhoeffer meant when he wrote in his letters and papers from prison that the world has come of age. Yet even as we explore what it means to find ourselves in this world come of age, it is important to remember that the most vibrant and concrete aspect of Bonhoeffer's theology was the childlike aspect of his faith, the holy and mysterious optimism he used as a compass through the world. Using his work as inspiration, I want to give some ideas about how UUs define a childlike faith and what tools we use to fill our journey through life, not only with hope, but also with the responsibility born of faith to, as Reverend Galen Gingrich put it this week at General Assembly, leave a better world for our children and leave better children for our world. Bonhoeffer reminded us in the opening reading, there is a silly, cowardly kind of optimism that we must condemn. I think Bonhoeffer would ask us to examine how a childlike faith is both an obstacle and an inspiration for the growth of a Unitarian Universalist open-eyed optimism in a world come of age. When Bonhoeffer said, the world has come of age, he was in many ways referring to the onset of a scientific worldview led by Darwin. Suddenly, a new concept of creation and nature's capacity to create itself exploded into human consciousness. The legacy of the Enlightenment was also gaining a stronger foothold. Reason and secular philosophy were portals to revelation as much as the Bible or religious ritual. These were not negative developments necessarily, but they were drawing humankind out of their reverence for God's mysteries and into an age where it seemed anything could be explained through the aid of human intellect. In the world of theology, reason and logic were beginning to be used to explore God and faith, as if even intangible mysteries of the soul and universe could be pinned down and studied like insects. The existence of God was now an empirical question. In June 1944, Bonhoeffer wrote to his friend Eberhardt, "The movement towards man's autonomy has in our time reached an undoubted completion. Man has learnt to deal with himself and all questions of importance without recourse to the working hypothesis called God. In questions of science, art, and ethics, it is becoming evident that everything gets along without God, and in fact, just as well as before." Bonhoeffer concludes that the world has lost its former religious innocence in the process of fighting world wars and discovering self-reliance. In the same way an adult can no longer believe in human perfection or the tooth fairy. Bonhoeffer argued that the people of the world had discovered that they did not need God to conduct their daily lives or to be happy. To force them back into an ancient, stiff, unchanged faith did not incorporate the new extended boundaries of knowledge and human capability. This was like asking a grown person to return to their adolescent state and be satisfied with this restricted existence. Bonhoeffer's world had come of age, shaking off the notions of a blind, childlike faith sewn together with miracles and God's infallibility. The impossible grounding of the Christian faith could no longer comfort adult minds faced with the horrors of human destruction. In Bonhoeffer's mind, a new strand of faith had to be discovered. One could argue that Bonhoeffer was living in a time more desperate than our own. He wrote, "Everything I have read thus far this morning while waiting to die at the hands of humanity's dark side." As a Christian, he was searching out a way to reconcile such suffering and mass destruction with the existence of God's presence in the world. Writing to his godson in May 1944, Bonhoeffer said, "We have learned by experience that we cannot even plan for the coming day, that what we have built up is being destroyed overnight, and that our life, in contrast to that of our parents, has become formless or even fragmentary. In spite of that, I can only say that I have no wish to live in any other time than our own, even though it is so inconsiderate of our outward well-being. It will be the task of our generation not to seek great things, but to save and preserve our souls out of the chaos, and to realize that it is the only thing we can carry as a prize from the burning building." This is where I hear Bonhoeffer speaking to us. I think he would have wanted us to plan for greater things beyond ourselves and make progress toward a happier, safer, and more just life. When I consider what my own world's coming of age means and how my generation is reacting to it, I feel a clear sense of urgency that something has been lost. It is different than what the world gave up in Bonhoeffer's time, because the thought of secularism overtaking religion is no longer an idea so new that it stings. It is deeply ingrained in my generation to be skeptical of magic. There's an overload of images, information, and emotion, as we know, a plethora of technological wonders for better and for worse. There is immediate access to the knowledge that people in Pakistan have died in a car bombing. People mourn the loss of my friend's father on her Facebook wall in passing, unlike the elaborate stationery my grandmother sends at every chance to celebrate or to mourn. Every magazine rack I pass in New York City is a candy shop of scantily clad women begging for cheap and quick attention, trying desperately to teach the women of my generation to do the same. I'm not sure our society's general disconnect from human emotion and meaningful contact is correlated to a loss in faith, but I do know that I don't want Bonhoeffer to see some of the trends we are setting. If all I focus on are the shows and magazines offered to me, I see a society that has predominantly replaced its innocence with a desire to be shocked and horrified by human depravity and shallowness. In some ways, I would say we are being taught to remain childlike, but not in the way of faith in the goodness of others or the potential of society. Many are content to live in their own small worlds, as if, like children, they do not understand their place in the greater world community or responsibility as its citizen. When I see music videos of young people staring into the camera, I think of a societal trend toward being tied up in image obsession and material excess, so much so that we cannot respond to Bonhoeffer's words and begin working for the betterment of the world for those who will follow. Today, the world has come of age, and that there are no secrets about the lives of people thousands of miles away. And our understanding of society and the world is more adult in that the truth of war and poverty is shown to us daily, whether we take it in or not. There are fewer mysteries that interest the general population, it sometimes seems. The world we find ourselves in today is similar to Bonhoeffer's world come of age. Only this world has radicalized the meaning of replacing the reverence for old mysteries with current satisfaction. For a moment, it can seem wise to condemn optimism. But when Bonhoeffer said the world of age, come of age, did not need a religious understanding of life to find happiness and peace anymore, he did not mean this was also the end of optimism and human hope. Bonhoeffer insists that science, reason, modernity do not leave us faithless, but with a new sense of responsibility for the world we now live in. There may be less general acceptance of spiritual blessings and religious figures as heads of authority, but maybe we have to replace old religious icons and names with modern icons, naming our spiritual experiences differently than in ancient times. Perhaps God is now the name for our insistence that our relations with one another be just and equitable, as much as kind and well-intentioned. Maybe in the world come of age, our religious devotion is the plans we make to ensure the peaceful and just existence of generations to follow. If we are more squarely planted in this world than the next, than ever before in human history, then it is time to prepare for a better earthly future, refusing, as Bonhoeffer said, to surrender all responsibility to bring the divine good into our world by claiming that the meaning of present events is chaos, disorder, and catastrophe. If the world has come of age, it's time to consider the fact that this implies we have left the place where we were once children and harbored the faith of a child. We also must ask the question, are there any aspects of childlike faith we still value? Of course, childlike faith conjures images of Jesus explaining to his disciples that only those with a childlike, innocent faith will enter the kingdom of heaven. To me, this means that those who obey without questioning, blindly believing, are favored by God. This has its place, but that method doesn't often work well for Unitarian Universalists. We prescribe more to the childlike faith that constantly asks questions and refuses simple answers or simple paths to peace and justice. So what does a childlike faith mean for us? Personally, in many ways, my childlike worldview is still firmly in place, but I can remember events that have changed my innocence. I recall learning that my parents could feel disappointment or take on too much and make mistakes. My teachers told dirty jokes when they weren't at school and even gossiped about the students in their classes. These were abrupt steps in the direction away from my childlike, simplistic view of human perfection. Human perfection has never been a basis of UU faith. Most UUs do not even allow Jesus a spot of divine perfection. Yet even if we don't believe in human perfection, we believe in the good of all souls around us, as a child would, never giving up on the possibility that it is people with their hopes and ambitions that will mend this world where it is broken and encourage good where it is thriving. In that way, our faith is childlike. I also remember the slow process of realizing that my simplistic childhood lens of understanding could not lead me to ultimate truth. One of the first people to teach me to sharpen the picture I had of the world was my 10th grade US history teacher, Mr. Campbell. Mr. Campbell taught me how to think intellectually, He asked us to write about the Sons of Liberty who used guerrilla war tactics on the British to win the American Revolution. He posed the question, were the Sons of Liberty patriots or terrorists? This was mind-blowing to me. I was now expected to consider every topic from multiple perspectives. Mr. Campbell taught me to form opinions and be wary of accepting anything that was spoon-fed to me. Unitarian Universalism encourages me to do the same, considering a multitude of methods for accessing what is divine or fulfilling, and constantly questioning tradition or ritual that in its mindlessness may have become corrupt or inaccessible to some. In the traditional sense, I suppose Mr. Campbell took away my ability to see the world as a child does, in shades of black and white. I still indulge that part of myself by watching Star Wars or reading Harry Potter. It can feel so pleasant and reassuring to return to that childlike simplicity in which the good guys wear this color, the bad guys wear this color, and a straightforward battle is always going on between the two, in which the good side conquers against impossible odds. But Unitarian Universalism doesn't encourage this view of heaven versus hell, pure versus sinful. We are involved in the swirling forces of morality, guilt, fear, love. We are responsible for deciding which forces we allow to live through our actions. I'm not sure this is something a child can consciously decide, even if our idealized view of a childhood psyche tells us that children naturally choose what is kind and just. Many of my fellow seminarians find their faith deepest when they do not question, but give up their frustrations to God's mysterious ways. My UU faith does not allow me to experience the divine mystery in the same way. The holy mystery of comfort that I feel around me must be prodded and poked, stretched and re-examined for all my life as I continue to find and give up various aspects of what I believe constitutes ultimate truth. This is another aspect of the UU faith that is childlike, our never-ending inquisitiveness. We will not let our concept of the divine or the meaning of life rest long enough to solidify into dogma. Like the child who asks why until every existential layer of a simple question is exposed. When I think of us living in Bonhoeffer's world come of age, I also think about us rejecting an authoritative parental God. If we make God or our concept of what is divine or ultimately satisfying an authoritative parent figure, leaving us as children, I think we limit our creativity, forcing ourselves to set sacred possibility in concrete as a distant being instead of a very real presence that continues to create the world alongside us. We cannot be children in faith because we have to work to bring the ultimate goodness into being here and now. In the words of Bonhoeffer, that bold, open-eyed optimism that is will for the future, that should never be despised, even if it is proved wrong 100 times, for it is health and vitality. One of the biggest parts of growing up is accepting responsibility. If the world we inherit is not as we think it is, the challenge to reimagine, rediscover, and recreate new and possible divine and human realities is in our hands. But in order to carry out our spiritual and moral responsibilities as Unitarian Universalists, we must realize that the childlike aspects of our faith can provide us with spiritual endurance. Our belief in the goodness of people, our inquisitiveness, and the staunch optimism that keeps us building a better world here and now. Our childlike faith matters immensely, and we must hold it close. The closing words are an excerpt from Jack Gilbert's poem, A Brief for the Defense. We must risk delight. We can do without pleasure, but not delight, not enjoyment. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world. To make injustice the only measure of our attention is to praise the devil. If the locomotive of the Lord runs us down, we should give thanks that the end had magnitude. We must admit there will be music despite everything. As we extinguish our chalice, our worship has ended. Let our service begin.